Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we've got Rick Marini. Rick is the co-founder, president, and chief operating officer of Rails. Rick, welcome to the podcast.
Christian, thank you. It's great to be here.
Oh, well, you know, when I saw you come across the applications list, and you know, and as I started reading through your background, I was like, oh my gosh, I absolutely gotta have you on here, because I know our audience is gonna love hearing about your background and career progression leading up to Rails. So with that, let's start from the beginning. You know, would love to, you know, understand how it progressed to co-founding the company.
Sure. Oh, I can take your way back to where it all started, I guess. So let's see, I'm originally from a small town in New Hampshire, and undergrad went to University of New Hampshire, and then started my career basically in kind of investment banking kind of work and M&A. And then from there, went to Harvard Business School for my MBA and met my first co-founder, a guy named James Currier, who's still one of my best friends today. And we started our first company. So my background, really, I'm a serial entrepreneur. I've founded five companies. I've invested in about 60 early stage tech companies as an angel. But it really started in 1999 with my classmate, James Currier. We started a company called Tickle, and that was back in Cambridge. And we were lucky enough to get it funded the day before the dot-com crash, which was March 5th of 2000. And we moved out to San Francisco from Boston.
Make sure they hit.
Yeah, that was a roller coaster, right? So we started at the dot-com, you know, boom, and we moved out to San Francisco in the bust, in the crash. So, but we made it through. We made it through and did actually quite well. Tickle became a top 20 site in the entire world at one point. We had a lot of traffic, and we sold that company to Monster, which was a big company back then, for $100 million. So that was a great outcome. We had only raised one round of capital. And then from there, continue to do some other startups and angel investing, and got into crypto in 2014 and started the first fund of funds ever in crypto in 2017. But then from there, I was lucky enough to be part of the group that acquired Grindr. So if you know Grindr, it's the largest online dating platform focused on LGBTQ. And my partners and I partnered with another PE firm, and we acquired Grindr. So that was a big one. Happy to dig in there, but I was chief operating officer at Grindr. And we came in to a company that was previously owned by a Chinese company called Kunlun that had acquired it from the original founder, Joel. And we came into a company that was CFIUS. It was a CFIUS for sale, so the Committee for Foreign Investment in the U.S. And came in and did some good work there. And I'll dig in more in a moment. And ended up taking that company public on the New York Stock Exchange. And then after that, co-founded Rails, the crypto perpetual exchange that I'm co-founder and running with my partners. So that's the kind of the progression, and I'm happy to throw it back to you and dig in on anything that's interesting.
Yeah, oh my gosh, there's a bunch here. So let's go back to Tickle. So what prompted the move from Massachusetts to SF?
Yeah, so you know, we knew that Silicon Valley is really the center of technology for the world. You've got, you know, the convergence of the entrepreneurs and the investors all in one place. And coming from Boston, like I said, I'm a Boston guy. People were really guarded with their information and what they're doing and want you to sign an NDA. And then we get to Silicon Valley and we realize ideas are easy, execution is hard. right? So people are open to, hey, I'm working on this. What are you working on? And people are, they may be competitive, but they're also collaborative. It was a totally different environment. And on Sand Hill Road, that's where most of the VCs have offices, and that's where a lot of the investment for these tech companies come from. So we knew that if we really wanted to be in the heart of technology, we need to be in Silicon Valley. I think if you're an actor, you should probably go to LA. And if you're in finance, you should probably be in New York. So we realized we need to be there. And when we finally, after many, many months of trying to raise money, when we finally raised money from August Capital, that's when we made the move. And my business partner, James, named his kid West because he was like, we're going West and I am committed. And I thought we'd be out here for a few years, build up the company and flip it and come back. My dog is named Fenway. I'm a Boston guy. But the longer I was here, the more I loved it. And that was 26 years ago.
Super exciting. And can you dial us into Tickle? What problem was it solving in the market?
So Tickle became the largest online personality testing site in the world. And the original spark was at Harvard Business School. You've got a bunch of highly competitive, type A people. We took the Myers-Briggs test there. This is back in 1998. And it was paper and pencil, and you take it and you send it in. And then months later, you get your results and you kind of forgot about it. But then we saw everyone started to open up and talk about, oh, I'm an ENTJ, you're an INTF. Now I understand how, how we get along or don't get along. So we saw that and said, wow, the internet, this new thing, in 1998, this internet could do all of this immediately and make it more fun and shareable and viral. So that was the original spark. So we started doing personality tests online, and the first ones we did were really serious, like Myers-Briggs and anxiety and depression. And it turns out those are not very viral and not very shareable. So we pivoted and we said, okay, we have these PhDs on staff. What can we do about, making your personality something that's fun and shareable? So we said, okay, people like their pets. We said, what about what breed of dog are you? So we are going to have our PhDs that are like, do you really want me to write a test that is basically assessing someone's personality and then assigning a dog type? And that's the test that changed everything for us because that got viral. People wanted to say, oh, you're a German Shepherd and I'm a Collie and whatever it was. So that's the one that really took off for us. And got us noticed and eventually funded.
Wow. And then, so you said you closed around right before the dot-com boom crashed. I'm curious, I know it's been over a quarter century now, but do you recall how your investors' demeanor, or what was your investors' demeanor? Did it change at all? Did you find that all of a sudden they were sitting up more straight in their chair, or was it business as usual?
Well, so we had a interesting situation where we had to probably talk to more than 20 investors who were all like, I don't know why people would take these personality tests online. I don't understand why they're doing this. And then when we had that one that hit the dog test, and then in February we followed up with who's your celebrity crush, and then we had all these celebrities. One of them was Howard Stern, and everyone started calling his show and saying, "Oh, this new website Tickle said I'm you're my celebrity," and they called us and said, "Okay, we need to do a partnership. Everybody's calling us." Once we hit that point and got really national recognition, that's when the VCs understood what we were doing. And that's when we were able to get Andrew Anker and David Hornick from August Capital to invest. Now, the interesting part here is that, like I said, they invested the day before the dot-com crash happened. 30 days later, James and I realized, okay, this isn't a blip in the NASDAQ and it's going to come back. This is a slide down. And that's when we went to, and this was a hard decision at the time, we went back to Andrew and David, and we said, okay, it's clear this is not a blip. If you would like your money back, your $9 million back, we will give you your money back. And we knew at that point, after we had, you're in the dot-com crash, like that the company would be over, but we thought that was the right thing to do. They came back, said, we believed in you last month, we believe in you going forward, let's do this. And we never had the conversation again because we gave them the option. And fortunately, everyone did the right thing because we ended up selling and they did very well on the deal.
Fantastic. That's a great story, and I love
Thank
that.
you.
Kudos to you both for having the wherewith, well, I don't know wherewithal, but character to be able to go to them, knowing that as far as we knew, the world was going to change materially for the foreseeable future. All right, so fast forward, how did Grindr end up on your radar?
So Grindr was a kind of a surprise, right? So really our accidental entrance into private equity is Jibjab. So if you know Jibjab, the e-card company, we acquired Jibjab a couple years before Grindr. A friend of ours is a co-founder. He needed to sell it quickly because he had another piece of the business that Netflix was buying. So we came in, we swooped in and we bought Jibjab. And we're still on the board of Jibjab now, and it's a great company. But that was our accidental entrance because Greg called and said, "I need to sell this thing quickly." So then we started to look at other deals. We're like, "Okay, this is really interesting." Grindr, as I mentioned, was a CFIUS deal. So the Committee for Foreign Investment in the U.S. CFIUS, and people know CFIUS now because of TikTok. Because that was another one. CFIUS is basically a governmental organization that is meant to protect US trade secrets and data from getting into the hands of foreign powers that could be used for, negative ways. And Grindr was one of those that you can think about, politicians or leaders that are not out of the closet. Also, Grindr is GPS enabled, so you could follow troop movements, because it's basically embedded in their phone. So CFIUS forced a sale. Now, because Grindr is focused on LGBTQ, it was really interesting. A lot of the traditional buyers were not there in the process. There was always like someone conservative on the investment committee that was like, "We can't touch that." We went to try to raise money in the Middle East. They couldn't touch it. So luckily for us, the buyer set was significantly reduced. So we were able to partner with another PE firm. And what we saw in Grindr was incredible brand, super sticky, and the financials were amazing. But then you look at the Glassdoor rating, which was like 18 or 19%. How do the people still have jobs? The app rating was something like 1.8, 1.9 stars. You got to remember, 1 star is basically zero. So we look at this and we're like, wait, the financials are doing 100 million of revenue and about 45 million of EBITDA, incredible margins at scale, yet the ratings are so low. So we knew that there was a huge opportunity to come in there and really fix the company and accelerate growth.
Wow. And can you unpack the PE component first? I know we can devote an entire episode to what that deal must have looked like, but for members of our audience who I'm sure are a bit more curious as to how private equity worked for purposes of getting your LPs together and submitting a bid and getting through due diligence, what can you share with us at 30,000 feet?
Yeah, so let me talk first for your audience about some of the levers of private equity, and then I'll talk about how we apply those to Grindr. So private equity often will want to find a company with strong, stable cash flow because then you can lever up with debt, right? So, but you need to have stable cash flow to feel comfortable to be able to put debt on a business. So, and typically with debt, you could do anywhere from 3, 4, or 5 turns of debt. So, what that means is that if a company has 10 million of EBITDA, you might be able to put 30, 40, or even 50 million of debt on that company, and that 10 million of EBITDA should be able to service that debt plus interest over time. So that's one. Another component is coming in to a deal at a reasonable entry multiple, a multiple on EBITDA typically, and SaaS can trade on a multiple of revenue. And then a plan to increase EBITDA to then exit at a higher multiple. And again, the higher multiple times a higher level of EBITDA. And if you're able to do that with debt and do all three of these things together, then you could have a really positive financial outcome. So, how does that apply to Grindr? Grindr, we bought for $600 million, And of that 600 million, we put 200 million of debt. So call that roughly 4 turns of debt. I said they were doing about 45 of EBITDA. So about 4 turns of debt, which is again pretty industry standard. Then we had to raise 200 million of equity. We put some of our own money in, but that was a small component of the full 200. So we worked with the other private equity firm to raise 200 million of fresh equity to come in. And then the last 200 was a payment upon the exit. So there was another 200 million that was due to the seller, that Chinese company I mentioned, Kunlin, that was selling Grindr to us. So the first 200 million of any exit was going to go to them. So that's the full 600 million.
Yeah. And so, and forgive me, you might have said it earlier. Do you still have your ownership stake in the company today, or have you since exited it?
We exited. So what happened at Grindr is that we ran the company for 2.5 years. And really what happened is we knew that, given the management rating, that there was work to do. But when we came in, it was far worse than we expected. It was really run like a black box. No one knew what was going on. There's only five people that had equity. And we came in and we said, we are changing everything. We're doing a 180. Every single person here is going to get equity. We're going to be very transparent with what's going on. But we also knew that we were three straight guys coming in to run a gay dating site. So also on day one, we said, we are going to need all of your help because a lot of the employee base of Grindr is from that community. So what we tried to do is really just kind of break down those walls immediately and say, we want your help. You're going to have equity. We're going to work together with you. We understand what we don't know, but we do know consumer tech and we do know subscription businesses, but we need to understand, the nuances of gay dating versus straight dating and the nomenclature and understanding all of that. And we want your help. So we came in and normally, you'd want to do things in parallel. Here, it ended up being more of a serial process. The first part was we needed to fix a team. We ended up, and we don't normally do this, terminating 70% of the employees because they were C players and we wanted at least A minus players, if not A players, right? Because, the saying goes, B players attract C players. A players attract A players, right? So you want to bring it down to try to really keep the A players, which we did. That was like the first 9 months was resetting the team. Then from there, we realized the Chinese owners had done very little to maintain the tech stack. So we basically had to spend the next year fixing the tech stack. And then the last kind of 9 months or so, we could really drive product innovation. And in that last year, we were able to double the revenue to 200 million, double the EBITDA to about 92 million, and then take it public for 2 billion.
Wow. And okay, so you said you ended up giving equity to the staff who you kept on. Was that a consensus decision, or was there any one person in particular who's, insisted that that was the best approach?
So my partner, Jeff Bonfort and I, and our other partner, Gary Hsu, we're Silicon Valley guys, and that is the lifeblood of Silicon Valley is stock, right? I mean, people, they start these companies, these entrepreneurs start companies with a huge amount of risk on the table, and you need to have commensurate upside for that risk. The reward has to be there. And for most people, it's not in cash, it's about the upside in stock. And if I add the value, I want stock. So Jeff and I were insistent with the other PE firm that everyone is going to have stock that will, it will reflect their level in the company, of course, but we wanted everyone to have stock. And I remember when we took the company public, we're standing on the New York Stock Exchange floor. And our head of marketing came up to me. He was one of my direct reports, and he said, "Every single thing you said on day one, everyone's going to have stock. We're going to be transparent. We're going to work hard together. We're going to do this, and we're going to take this company public." He said, "Every single thing as of today, you guys did." And it felt so good for me because I know on day one, they were all like, "This is too good to be true." He said that to me later. He said, "Everything you, it was a 180 from where we were." They were like battered from, the Chinese ownership that they just didn't believe that we could do all that together. And we got there, and that day meant a lot to me, to have every single person on the New York Stock Exchange floor with us who made money.
What was the experience like taking the company public?
So I think people think of it the wrong way. I think people think of it like the Super Bowl. Like there's this like, moment that, it's like we did it and it's over and, and you all kind of ride off to the sunset. Here, the process of taking a company public, and this is, I think, the same for any company, it takes like a year. And it's a lot of meetings with lawyers and accountants and PR people and compliance people and the exchange. Like it is just a lot of meetings and a lot of preparation. But you have to do it. And the New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ or any of these, they want you to be buttoned down and have everything in proper order. And we did, and we got there. Now, I will say the day of the public offering at the New York Stock Exchange, I mean, the NYSE is kind of an old school organization. They had rainbow flags everywhere. I mean, they went all out for Grindr. It was amazing. And our employees, they were amazed because I think, they were, we were told to all wear suits. Now, some of our employees wore suits, sleeveless suits or whatever, because, they're, part of that community, which was great. And the New York Stock Exchange really embraced Grindr that way. So it was a wonderful day for the company, for our employees, for the community that we served. And the New York Stock Exchange did just a great job to facilitate that.
Fantastic. Okay, so now fast forward crypto. Bitcoin starts to gain everybody's attention. Let's just oversimplify and say it around 2010. How did it get your attention?
So I got into crypto in 2014. A friend of mine out here in Silicon Valley, Naval Ravikant, who also got me into angel investing. He's been a friend for many, many years. He was very early in crypto, maybe in 2010, 2011. And then he was talking about it. And then I started investing both in Bitcoin directly, but also in his fund, MetaStable. And then I started investing in some other funds. And what I loved about it is this, you could see a possible disruption to the way that money can be stored and flow. And Bitcoin really allowed for that kind of global adoption of a new currency. And so I'll give him credit that he kind of got me on board with that. He saw it first, and then I was, I guess, smart enough to listen to him and get involved back then. And then what I realized when I started Protocol Ventures, which was again the first fund of funds in crypto, is that I'm already investing in all these top managers, and most of the world has never heard of any of them because it's early days of crypto, 2014, and I'm investing in like Pantera and MetaStable and Polychain and in many of these who have gotten quite big now. Many of them have billions and billions of AUM. And I realized I'm friends with these people. I know, they're really good and they've got, great insights into the space. So that's when I started my crypto fund Protocol Ventures to basically piggyback off of what I was already doing individually.
All right. And so how many funds did you end up doing in Protocol?
Well, we just did one. We did one fund of funds and invested in what I think were kind of the top 10 crypto funds and did that. And then I ended up doing Grindr, and another partner of mine took over Protocol.
Got it. And so I'm curious, back when you were having your LP conversations for Protocol, given it was still early innings for crypto, how did those conversations go?
I think there was a lot of excitement, right? So this is like, 2017 in particular is when Bitcoin just kind of went parabolic. So I think there was a lot of FOMO, right? So like, wait, all these people are making money in crypto. I want to get in too, but I don't know what to do. So the conversation was, hey, I've been in the space for several years. Here's the fund managers that I've invested in, and here's why I think they're interesting. And we're going to do this with a portfolio approach, right? We're going to pick the top 10 fund managers. And I think for a lot of people, as I was raising money, they felt like I need some exposure into crypto. I clearly don't know how to do it on my own. And Rick, everything you're saying with these fund managers makes sense to me. And let's go in with that, diversified approach.
Got it. Okay, so now let's fast forward to Rails. What year did you start the company or
So
co-found the company?
we started Rails about 3 years ago, so 2023. And Rails is a what we call a hybrid perps exchange, so perps perpetuals. And the hybrid part is, FTX that everybody remembers back in the day was the best crypto trading platform in terms of the speed of execution and the breadth of assets. And it was all great until they did the wrong thing with Alameda Research, their sister company, and using user funds to be able to do what's called market making. Now, if they had never done that, FTX would still be around and they'd probably be the biggest exchange in the world. So what we saw when FTX went down was the hybrid approach was how do you bring centralized order processing, so the very fast execution of trades, how do you do that in a safe way? So what we've done is that we've brought our custody on chain. So what happens is users deposit funds with us. We put that in a smart contract, which lives on the blockchain. And at Rails, we never actually touch their funds. Their funds stay locked in a smart contract. And then you're basically taking a virtual equivalent of those funds and trading in our system. And then when you want to liquidate, when you want to exit, we would then take the difference of any profit or loss you've had and unlock those from the smart contract. Right. So we've done it in a way where we think this is the best of both worlds, centralized order processing for quick execution, combined with very safe on-chain custody with smart contracts. And from day one, we've done this in a compliant, regulated way. So we are regulated in the Cayman Islands. We have our CEMA registration. We also have our NFA pending registration in the US. So from day one, we've done this in a regulated, compliant way.
So fast forward to today, it's February 26. I'll oversimplify trading, and let's say some of it's speculative, some of it's hedging, some of it's long-term investment. You have a sense of the people who are active and leveraging Rails? What's their predominant focus?
Yeah, so because Rails is perpetuals, and you can think of as perpetuals as you are going either long or short. You are just taking a bet directionally. So a lot of those folks are going to be more speculative, right? So it's not typically just a buy and hold. So most people, if you're just going to buy and hold, you might be trading on Coinbase. You might just say, I want to buy $10,000 of Bitcoin and forget about it and let it go. Rails, because it's perps or perpetuals, it is more speculative. I believe that Bitcoin or whatever asset is going to go up or down in a shorter period typically than someone who's just a long-term holder. So we have a lot of those types of traders. And also because we are compliant and regulated, we can have institutional investors as well who tend to get spooked with DEXs, decentralized exchanges, which are not regulated.
Got it. And so, and the business, how is it generating top line? Is it all transaction fees?
Yeah, so it's transaction fees. So very typical for an exchange. So you've got trading volume, and then you take a small percentage of the trading volume as a fee.
Got it. And as we're recording this, it's February 2026. A reoccurring conversation with the Trump administration is further democratizing crypto. I'm curious, you're in a really unique position. What do you see?
Well, listen, we want regulation. So democratizing crypto, I think, is a great thing. And that was one of the early kind of tenets of crypto, again, when I got in 12 years ago. But what I think is more interesting for the Trump administration is a push towards regulation, right? Because that's really what most people who are the good people of crypto, we've been just saying, just give us regulation. We want to be compliant, but previously the SEC, head of the SEC, Gary Gensler, didn't want to give specific guidelines on what we need to do. It was more about, well, if we don't like it, we're going to come after you. And that's not a good way to grow an industry. Give us the guardrails, give us the guidelines, and then the good guys, we will be compliant with that. So I give the current administration credit for trying to push forward guidelines. We're still not there yet. I mean, some of these bills are still being debated, but I think directionally that's where we want to be. You know what I mean? Just give us the clarity on what we need to do, and then you can grow an industry in the right way together.
And if you had to put your finger on what can be holding back defining regs, is there any one thing, or is it a combination of things?
Well, I mean, it's definitely a combination, but one of the big things is just an ongoing debate, I think, and it's not necessarily red state, blue state, but if you were to, if you wanted to try to break it down that way, I think a lot of Republicans who might be capitalists are like, let's go forward with this. We want, we don't want the U.S. to be behind other countries. So let's go forward. I think a lot of Democrats might say, hey, well, we got to be careful. We don't want mom and pop to lose money. So we need to be careful and protect them. Both sides have good arguments, right? I'm a capitalist. I want to grow this industry, but I don't want anyone to lose money and I don't want anyone to be scammed, right? So I'm actually in the middle of that, which is, hey, if we have companies that are following the rules in a compliant way, then hopefully mom and pop small investor aren't going to lose their money. There's always going to be scammers and all that kind of stuff in any industry. But if we do the right thing, then we should protect those that the Democrats may want to protect, and let us run fast and go build something big within the rules, right? So I think that's the friction, right? The friction is we don't want you to run too fast because we got to protect. But I think for someone like me, it's like I do want to protect them, but give me the rules. So let's go. So I'm hopeful that later this year we get through that debate and get some clarity and some laws passed, and then let the good guys go build.
Are there any industry groups who are proposing regulations, who are spearheading a push to bring this into legislation?
Absolutely, yeah. So there's a blockchain group that is headed by some industry experts that are working with government officials, and I think they're doing a good job, I think, to say, hey, this is what it should look like. And I think they're smart enough to realize, it's got to appeal to both sides for it to get passed. So you can't just say we want it to look like this and forget about regulation. We just want to run fast. No, you've got to address both sides. And I think they're doing a good job educating government officials. Here's the other thing holding some of it back is that it's still a new industry, and it's a pretty complex technology, and a lot of the politicians are lawyers, not necessarily technologists, right? So they're still trying to wrap their head around what is this? So like when you say the money is held in a smart contract on the blockchain, what does that mean? Where is the money? You know what I mean? So there's things like that that just take education and a knowledge transfer, and that stuff takes time. And when you're dealing with people's money, you got to be careful.
So, notwithstanding, eventually, at some point in our lives, we get some regs, and it defines the guardrails. What's your outlook, or long-term outlook for the industry and the asset class?
Well, I think what's interesting right now is that TradFi, traditional finance, is really finally starting to bridge in to crypto and get really interested. And I think, they may see like, hey, if we don't do something here, we may get disrupted. So it may be defensive, not just offensive. The offensive would probably be what we've been doing, playing offense for the last 15 years, trying to build in crypto. And I think TradFi is starting to say, hey, this is going to be interesting on, payment rails and movement of money. Yes, there's I know Brad Garlinghouse, who's a friend, likes to say this about Ripple. It's easier to you could use Ripple, or you could use really any stable coins now, to move money in a matter of seconds, where if it's Friday night and you want to wire money to like London or whatever, you're better off getting on a plane with bags of cash on Friday to get there on Saturday to pay that your person. Where with crypto, you could literally do it in a matter of seconds in a safe, secure way. So I think a lot of TradFi is seeing this and realizing if we don't do something here, we will be disrupted. So it's not that they're trying to necessarily make money out of, with crypto. I think they're seeing some of the maturity of the technology and efficiency with the crypto rails and the blockchain to be able to store and move money.
This is a little bit in the weeds, but as I'm listening, are there any, so obviously there's a tremendous amount of benefits of having fast settlement, but I'd also imagine that historically a settlement is slow, makes it maybe a little bit easier to stop fraud. Is there a conversation within crypto today of additional steps that can be taken to make sure that, if someone gets a hold of your wallet keys, or someone makes a mistake, that there's still an opportunity to, prevent a transaction going through or undo a transaction.
Yeah, so let me answer that in two ways. One, when you're working with regulated entities that do KYC, KYB, AML, you know both sides of the transaction. When you're doing that, you're in a much, much safer place because you know both parties. Okay. So those transactions are going to be, very safe. The other thing is that most exchanges have a limit on how much could be sent out on any given time frame, like let's say in one day. So let's say that the limit, make up a number, is $50,000. If a scammer is trying to move $50 million or $5 million or whatever big number out of your account, again, a lot of these exchanges will limit that and you will get a notice. I know, I do, in addition to Rails, I was, trading on Coinbase as well, and they also have limits. And they will send you an email to be like, wait, please confirm, are you trying to move $5 million right now? And if you're not, you're going to be calling them or typing like, no, stop this transaction. So I think there's some guardrails already. The other thing about crypto that I think a lot of people don't understand, especially when people are like, oh, well, crypto is just a bunch of like criminals and scammers and whatever. It's like, do you realize that everything is traced on the blockchain? Like crypto is a terrible place for criminals to move money because it's actually traceable on the blockchain. US dollars, or any hard currency is much easier to be able to do nefarious things than having a currency tracked on the blockchain. Okay, all that said, of course, there are scammers out there that will scam someone into sending them Bitcoin or, because people, fall for something, which is unfortunate and sad. It's hard to get that money back. It is. And especially if it's a smaller amount, government agencies may not get, as, excited to try to track down those. So I would just say that is something that's very hard for any industry to solve, those scammers. So just be very careful. When you're going to send crypto, just know who you're sending to on the other side.
Makes good sense. Sounds like there's an opportunity for the next entrepreneur to come up with a way to further increase security, but we will see. Rick, learned a ton. Really amazing career progression. Would love to know. Always opportunities to do things better, but sometimes things happen exactly as they're supposed to, or at least there's agreement that that's the case. As you reflect back, any advice you'd give your younger self or things that you would you'd do different?
Well, for advice, I think the advice that, I've got two kids, and the advice I give them, or really anyone that I talk to that, is asking for advice, I do a lot with, I mentioned UNH, and I'm a guest speaker there quite a bit in those classes. And the three things that I tell them are all free. And I still use these today, but they're really important early in your career. Number one, use good judgment. Number two, work harder than everyone around you. And number three, have a positive attitude. Most people are willing to do two of those, but not necessarily three. And why those are so important is that when you're early in your career, when your managers see, okay, this person continues to have good judgment in what they're doing here on a given project, man, they work really hard. They are always here working their butt off, and they have a good attitude. They have a growth mindset. They just want to continue to learn and produce and be around great mentors. Those are the people that get promoted. Okay. So if you are looking to progress in your career, if you do those three things, and whatever you're in, it could be investment banking, could be tech, could be legal, could be whatever. I mean, any blue collar, anything. People above you, when they see you do those three things, they want to mentor you. They want to promote you. They want you on their team. It is so simple. It costs nothing, but if you do those three things, doors open. And then from there, you continue to use good judgment. And how long do you stay at a company when you've got great mentors, or when is it time maybe to go back to school or go to a new company? Continuing to exercise, that good judgment and always being a hard worker and having a good attitude. It just goes so far in life and such really simple advice.
I concur. I love it. Good stuff. Before we wrap up, anyone in your network, personally, professionally, that you'd love to give a shout out to for having a material impact on you over the years?
Well, I think I actually mentioned a couple of them. So, and these are some of my closest friends as well. But, my classmate from business school, James Currier, we started our first company together. We're still, incredibly close friends. So I would say James is someone who is one of my best friends, but also kind of a mentor because James is 5 years older than me. And that was really important. Like when I was 26 and we were starting Tickle and he was 31, he had, that 5 years ahead of me. So I'd say James Currier has had a huge impact on me. Jeff Bonfort, my business partner, and we did Grindr together where he was CEO and I was COO, still one of my best friends and my, one of my business partners. So Jeff, Naval Ravikant, I mentioned, who got me into angel investing, and I've done 60 angel investments. I've got 15 unicorns out of those 60, and he got me into angel investing, but then got me into crypto. And then number four, Satraj Bhambra, who is my co-founder at Rails and our CEO. He is an incredible crypto trader, incredible, technology mind and trader. So he's someone special. So those four people, I'd say, in terms of my career, have really had a big impact on me. And for me, I want to work with people that that also embody those three things that I just said: good judgment, work hard, and are smart. And the five people you hang out with the most have a huge impact on who you are and your personality. So it's so important to me to align with people that I have a ton of respect for, that I can be complimentary to. All those people I just named, by the way, all four of them, I would say are all big thinkers, visionaries in their fields. And where I come in as a COO, is that I'm the execution guy, right? And they are the big ideas, a big vision, but you need both, right? So you when you're co-founding a company, find that complementary person that has one or the other. And by the way, in time, you get to have the experience and hopefully maturity to understand where you are. Everybody wants to be the CEO. And I was a CEO of BranchOut, which I skipped over. We had raised $49 million for BranchOut. It became one of the biggest apps on Facebook. And I was a good CEO, but I think I'm a great COO. So you eventually figure out, okay, where am I really best suited? And then what do I bring to the table? And then how do I partner with other people that bring what I'm missing? And how do I add to what they need? And when you bring all that together with the right people, you can end up having, a great journey. And I got to share that with you today.
That's fantastic. I think that's great counsel. Know thyself and then, recognize where there's opportunity to complement the best of us and surround yourself with them. Rick, genuinely appreciate your time. If there's any members of our audience who'd like to get a hold of you, either because they want to join Rails, maybe they want to invest, how can they find you?
So I'm on Twitter. I'm Armor at Armorini. Rails is www.rails.xyz. If you want to check out Rails, please do. If you're into crypto trading, please check us out. And you can find me on LinkedIn. So I'm out there.
Fantastic. And again, for the benefit of our audience, Rick Marini, co-founder, president, chief operating officer of Rails. Rick, thank you so much.
Christian, this has been a great conversation. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And again, thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators Investors Podcast. Take care. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag innovators and investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.